Very popular young violinist Janine Janssen and the Gewandhaus Orchestra, led by Ricardo Chailly, in Max Bruch's first violin concerto. He really struggled over the composition of it, though. He kind of worried, and it premiered, and then he wanted to rework it, and finally the violinist Josef Joachim helped out. I'm Lynn Warfel.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Thank you for being here and for enjoying this lovely classical programming. Some other shows that you might like to try out here at WHFR include every Monday afternoon from 2 until 4 p.m. It's called Big Band with Dan, some of the greatest big band programming that you will ever want to hear, taking you back to those days gone by. Again, Big Band with Dan, Monday afternoons, 2 to 4 p.m., right here on WHFR. Also, Fridays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m., we present The World of Big Band with Bill Wright. You'll enjoy this so much as well. The World of Big Band, Fridays, 10 a.m. until 1 p.m., right here on WHFR. And, of course, if you're tuning in for Big Band on Fridays, stay tuned for another hour in the 1 o'clock time slot. It's the new WHFR Journal. Local news and views at their best. All sorts of great programming here on WHFR. Check them out. Thanks for tuning in.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
Morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. in the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you. Well, here we are back after 4 weeks, and our program today has to do with the genesis of the terminology of genocide and something about its history. And our guest today, and I'm going to read his biography, is Ruben Adalian. Ruben, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for the invitation.
It's my pleasure, and it's always interesting to find people with very special backgrounds. This is Mr. Adalian's biography. He is the director of the Armenian National Institute, located in Washington, D.C., and we are today speaking to him on the telephone. He is not with us. So here we go with his background. We have a shortened version. Mr. Adalian is the director of the Armenian National Institute, ANI as it is known, in Washington, D.C., an organization founded in 1997 and dedicated to the study, research, and affirmation of the Armenian genocide. He is a specialist on the Caucasus and the Middle East and has taught at a number of universities, including the School of International Affairs, George Washington University, the School of Foreign Service, Georgetown University, and the School of Advanced International Studies, John Hopkins University. But he doesn't want to be called professor. From 1987 to 1996, he was the Director of Academic Affairs and Director of the Office of Research and Analysis of the Armenian Assembly of America. In 1993, he completed a project to document the Armenian genocide in the United States National Archives. As a result, Chadwick Healy Incorporated published a 37,000 pages of American evidence on microfiche. The accompanying 476-page guide to the Armenian genocide in the U.S. archives, dated from 1915 through 1918, was issued in 1994. Adalyan is the associate editor and resource editor of the Armenian Genocide of the award-winning Encyclopedia of Genocide 1999 and has contributed to a number of publications including Genocide in Our Time 1992, Genocide in the 20th Century 1995, Studies in Comparative Genocide 1999, Genocide, Essays Toward Understanding Early Warnings and Prevention, 1999. And the rest is in French, which you'll have to excuse. Actual Light du Genocide des Armeniens, 1999. Pioneers of Genocide Studies, 2002. America and the Armenian Genocide, 2003. And Century of Genocide, 2004, referring to the 20th century. He is the author of From Humanism to Rationalism, Armenian Scholarship in the 19th Century, 1992, and Historical Dictionary of Armenia, 2002, and editor of Armenia Factbook, 1994, and Armenia and Karabakh Factbook, 1996. Mr. Adalyan is also the compiler and editor of the ANI website, www.armenian-genocide.org, that holds extensive information on the Armenian Genocide. He received his Ph.D. in history from the University of California in Los Angeles. Well, as you can see, Mr. Adalyan is an expert not only on the Armenian Genocide, but our discussion today is going to go beyond the Armenian Genocide, but historically take this issue from the pre-20th century and talk about its definitions in four steps. The first part we will delve directly with pre-definition of genocide, in other words, prior to the 20th century, when we had histories of people massacring each other, but without that terminology, and why then we come to the First World War, and the actual beginning of that term deals with the Armenian Genocide, which we will talk about, so that would be World War I and its aftermath. And then we'll go into the post-World War I issues of the 1920s, how terms start to be developed, generally evolving around the Armenian Genocide. Then we'll go to post-World War II or World War II and the Jewish Holocaust, and then the definitions of genocide after that. And then the recent history of genocide, when we'll conclude in the part dealing with the Cambodian and Rwanda and our present Darfur issues, of which we hope he will bring some clarity to these four phases and make it more understandable for us how the term got started, who did it, what, and how did it come about. So I like calling you professor instead of mister, so.
That's fine.
So let's begin before the 20th century, why all of a sudden we seem to think that genocide begins with the Armenian Genocide and no one refers to anything that happened before as genocidal. You might give us a little background on that. I realize it doesn't take much time, but
genocide is thought of as a 20th century problem because essentially it's a state crime. It means that a government and or central authorities or people in power with access to the levers of the government use its institutions, use its resources to target a distinct population therein decide to physically eliminate it. The atrocities that come before the 20th century, while it might have involved the role of the government in at certain levels or on certain occasions, are not known to have been precipitated by any type of a central decision or by some central mechanism in order to do the kind of thorough elimination, the thorough extermination that the 20th century genocides exhibited.
So what we have is more better organized states and state policy as opposed to incidental armies conquering other armies and genocidal issues take place. But
quite so. Therefore, you know, the question of modernization, the modern state, and particularly the nation state, all factor in as very important elements in understanding why there is genocide and the way it's understood and ultimately codified in the 1948 UN Convention, and why that term is used less frequently or more loosely to refer to the atrocities and the massacres,
right,
which were just as frequent in, you know, prior to the 20th century.
That's an interesting point you're making, because I know from attending some seminars, and I'm jumping a little bit, the so-called 1909 massacres of the Armenians in the Turkish Ottoman Empire, I attended a seminar where the participant said that was not a genocidal issue because no one's quite sure whether the government ordained such a thing or there was some policy to do it, but so events transpired of people making individual decisions, so I guess that would meet your definition?
It would. One needs to be reminded that prejudice, race hatred, religious differences, all and economic and other issues could aggravate relations among various groups and individuals or parties that might want to take advantage of a situation of the like.
And the victims,
could organize a massacre. Say.
I see. So the victims generally are a minority as well.
It tends to be so because they're vulnerable, and that's another element that plays into genocide, but not necessarily always. But but the issue of vulnerability of vulnerable groups, which tend to be minorities, typically, obviously, is another consideration.
Well, I think that pretty well establishes why, when we talk about genocide, it seems to be a 20th century phenomenon, and the term is not used prior to that. I myself had not thought about it that way, but without the modern state and state policies, it seems that the definition doesn't apply, but it doesn't mean gross transgressions of power of one group on another or one army upon a defeated army. I was listening to a program of the Crusades and what transpired when the Crusaders entered Jerusalem the first time. So that takes us to where we want to go. Now we're at the 20th century and the prime time, the turning of the 20th century. Is there anything that transpired in history prior to the Armenian Genocide at the turn of the century, before 1915, that would give us some hints that this could be and might be a problem in the near future, say after the turn of the century?
Right. There are a number of developments in the early, late 19th, early 20th century that give indication that problems were to emerge and conceivably entrap various vulnerable populations, particularly populations in war zones, to unusual treatment and potentially elimination. The easiest to identify of these is simply the rise of militarism. The arming, the industrial arming of states with all of the new weaponry that had been invented in the late 19th century, and the expansion of the military establishments of the states that existed at the time, and one needs to be reminded that we're talking about empires: the German, the French, the British, the Russian, and the Ottoman. These being the Austro-Hungarian being the primary states the great powers, as they were called in the 19th and early 20th century.
Do we have any inkling of such a thing prior to 1915?
There is.
Like junior attempts?
There are interesting cases that are pointed out. For example, the conduct of the German colonizing authorities in Southwest
Africa.
Africa and in the treatment of local African populations and the decision on their exterminatory treatment. The interesting example of the mistreatment of the population in the Congo by the Belgian authorities, a state or a colony controlled personally by the King of Belgium, who exploited that population murderously. Those are a couple of examples that one can cite. And then the recurrent pogroms against the Jews in Russia.
Yes,
and the same with Armenians, so, and many more examples, but those are perhaps the ones that are...
Right, so the Jewish pogroms in Russia, in Tsarist Russia, prior to the turn of the century in the 1880s and 90s, would be an example of that. Well, that's interesting. I myself hadn't thought about the colonialists in Africa. Although they probably were not at the scale that we have learned, most of us know something about that came later at the turn of the century. Okay, that brings us to we're about a quarter of the way through the program. It's kind of hard to believe, isn't it? We're a quarter of the way done. So let me take a minute to introduce the program and myself and you. You are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM. We are the college radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, located in Dearborn, Michigan. I am Ned Apigyan, your host. The name of the program is Then and Now, and the point of the program is how history affects current events. There are issues that at the end of this program, when we talk about how current events between, most currently for us, that deal with Armenia and its relationship to Turkey, so on. Its roots begin in the Armenian Genocide, which we're going to get to. And our guest today is Professor Ruben Adalian, director of the Armenian National Institute in Washington. And so now that brings us to the part of the program where we discussed pre-definition of genocide. Now we're in the 20th century, World War I. How about what happened to the Belgians in Belgium, the Germans? There was this big, a lot of propaganda about the rape of Belgium. How does that compare? That happened before the Armenian Genocide in 1915. Could you say something about that?
Absolutely, because one could make the case that the mistreatment of the Belgians by the German imperial forces prepared the way, prepared by example, set the example for the Ottomans, because Germany violated Belgian neutrality. Belgium didn't.
What exactly did they do? I'm not familiar with general
first by
detail.
Violating, it was an invasion.
Right, they violated Belgium's neutrality.
And the level of mistreatment of the population was horrendous. And mind you, this is effectively the first time that human society was being exposed to the use of these tremendous weapons, industrial-scale weapons, which really hadn't been seen since the Civil War in the United States. And the level of destruction that these caused was enormous, as well as the type of treatment that was meted out to the Belgians, summary executions, evacuations, deportations, enslavement, and so forth.
So this is something
quite unexpected, according to the norms that had been agreed upon by at least the Europeans in the conduct of warfare.
Now that brings me to the definition that people used to say the Civil War was the first modern war, in the sense that it was total war. But it never involved civilians. Then we are having this history of the rape of Belgium, which most people today don't know anything about. But at the turn of the century, there were many interesting posters about the evil Hun. I don't know why they called the Germans Huns, because they certainly have nothing to do with the Huns that came into Europe centuries before. But how did that affect, did they not also invade Holland? It's neutrality. Why did they treat Holland differently than the Belgians?
Right, yeah, Holland was did not become embroiled in the war in the manner that Belgium was crushed because the armies
needed to pass through
Belgium.
So you mean the First World War, they didn't have to go through Holland?
Right.
Holland was spared the war?
Right.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
I think the point to make about Belgium, because I want to stay on that issue, is to emphasize the escalation of violence, the escalation of violence that came with the equipment of war and then the treatment of civilians. And this is what really opens a whole new chapter on modern warfare. And that, in turn, then sets a new, in a sense, a new level of tolerance or this kind of violence.
A new standard that goes all the way back to the bombing of Guernica, right, in the 30s. You know something? I didn't know that we would get to this point, but it's very illuminating. I had not thought about it like that, and I hope our audience, who's not... We're usually bombarded constantly about the Jewish Holocaust, which the last time I heard someone say there are over 970-some... films and documentaries pertaining to, so we are all pretty well aware of that. But the idea that the beginnings of this begin with the German involvement in the invasion of Belgium is really new to me, and I'm glad we ended up talking about that. Of course, there's that whole Hoover Institute of the post-World War I helping Europe recovery has to do with all that. Now, we've established pretty well that the beginnings of this are there in the 20th century. Still, we had no definition. It was referred to as the rape of Belgium, a euphemism about what the people suffered. Now we'll go to what you really know a lot about, where the definition of genocide really is defined because of the Armenian genocide in the Ottoman Empire. You might want to give us a background into how this developed and why it referred to, why later Lemkin gives the term genocide coming from the Greek and Latin words and so on. So let's talk about the Armenian genocide, how its beginnings developed and why it is a classic definition of genocide.
Much as we pointed out, the Armenians were a minority population of the Christian faith, and they were by this time living in an area, their historic homeland, Armenia itself, and other places that they lived in adjacent Anatolia and elsewhere, had all been incorporated in the Ottoman state, a state ruled by an Islamic population namely the Turks.
And a Turkish minority at that, isn't that not correct?
Well,
the Turks were a minority.
When the empire itself was at its zenith and covered all of southern, southwestern Europe, North Africa, the Middle East,
right,
the Turkish population would have been a minority. And that, but by the early 20th century, the Turkish elite and authorities were grappling with this issue of what to do with their decline, how to salvage their declining state, and how to deal with the continuing existence of other minorities, particularly non-Muslim minorities. And therein, the Armenians were a sizable factor.
Would you go into the loss? We've gone over their zenith, where, as you mentioned, Southeast Europe, North Africa. Could you explain? My own rationale was the decline of the empire due to the British coming to Greece in 1829, their loss of Greece proper. And then later, Libya, the loss to Italy in the war of 1909, and later the Balkan Wars. Would you talk about that? So why they became paranoid of their minorities?
Well, there were two processes working on the Ottoman Empire that was breaking it up. One was the competition with other major states, Russia, Austria-Hungary, Britain, as you know, France as well. There was another process which is typically described under the rubric of nationalism, and that there were emerging states, formerly conquered populations, were seeking independence in their own countries. And this is why you have the map of the Balkans as you have it today, where you essentially the conflicts that you observe or hear about in the news are in many ways the residue of the unresolved border problems, disputes, and the way those states were created as a consequence of the breakup.
If I can interrupt you for a moment, that's right. One of my primary contentions on my program is the unresolved issues of World War One. The concoctions of these states like Serbia or Yugoslavia from Serbia and Macedonia, all these things, these are problems we're living with today, hence Milosevic's attempt to consolidate Serbia. These issues, these unresolved issues of the First World War, hence the British and the French and the Middle East and their mandates, are still problems we're living with today. And this is the thing I'd like to see the average person appreciate. Otherwise, if you don't know the history of these things, you can't appreciate our current events. Please continue.
Well, the decline of the state by shrinking and losing all of these other territories created a problem for the Armenians in that by the early 20th century, they were the one most exposed group in the Ottoman Empire that had not been given any satisfaction either in the reforms, the reforming of a very repressive government, or in being given independence with their own country. And the then governing elite, namely a very specific group called the Young Turk Committee, or the Committee for Union and Progress, as they called themselves, came to the decision that it wanted to create a Turkish state, there were no longer these heterogeneous populations, non-Muslim populations, and the Armenians happened to live along the border with Russia. And the war provided the perfect cover then to really remove them from those areas and to do so with such violence that ultimately the majority of the population perished.
Would you take a minute or so to define pan-Turanianism? So my point is, you might want to develop it, is when they discovered they didn't believe they could hold the Islamic Arabic peoples to the south and were losing their status in the West, they look to their origins in the China, Mongolia, the Altai Mountains, and the reunification of all the Turkic-speaking people in Central Asia, and the Armenia was simply in the way of that joint union, at least the Armenians, even if there wasn't an Armenian state. Could you talk about that for a moment or so?
Well, that was, in a sense, one direction of the thinking of what to do or how to respond to the existence of a Russian state, how to respond to the existence of other Turkic populations. But in the main, their primary concern was the consolidation of their own state, the elimination of pockets of populations that were resistant, that were different, that did not participate in the culture and the language and the religion of the ruling authorities.
Or were not able to be Turkified in 600 years, so since that was obviously...
Right, and of course, in a increasingly nationally-minded elite, the resistance to assimilation of populations, and Armenians had been around for some 3,000 years by that point. They were a population living in their own homeland. They weren't minorities, in some remote region of the empire. This presented them with a serious challenge, or they saw this as a serious challenge and made it into a serious challenge. And for the Armenians who had lived within this empire in a very oppressive state that had never quite modernized and reformed, then their own modernization, their own improvements, presented a threat to the Turks themselves as they perceived it, because the rate of progression of their modernization went at different paces, and this proved to be threatening to the authorities as well. And so you have an economically skillful, industrious
minority
that has, you know, a certain amount of wealth, a certain amount of property, numerous businesses, and among the concepts entertained at this time, under the rubric of encouraging nationalism, was creating a national economy.
Interestingly enough, the Turks regarded the Armenians as the most loyal minority of all the minorities that they dominated. Is that not true? Because it seems to be, at least up until the turn of the century, the Armenians posed no real problems to them.
The Armenians never really posed a problem, and the reason they used that term is because the rest of the areas that they governed were always restive, whether it be Bulgaria, Serbia, as you cited, Romania, Greece, even the Arab provinces. There were always rebellions against the central authorities, against Turkish rule. Armenians never rebelled, exactly. The only instances where the Armenians took arms were typically in cases of self-defense, and quite commonly it tended to be not so much against Turkish authorities as much as the Kurdish elements, which tended to prey upon them.
So what's the Turkish expression for that? Isn't Kardashian mean brother in Turkish? The loyal are brothers? They had an expression for that. It's interesting that the genocide befell the most loyal of their minority subjects, because we were simply in the way of their pan-Turanian aspirations.
Right. What I'm arguing here that it was many more reasons, not one particular reason. And it is the combination of all of these reasons that led them to the conclusion that the remedy that they will resort to is indeed genocidal, since it isn't a question of any longer removing a population, deporting a population, sending them away, but rather exterminating physically. And this is really the turning point in the way governments begin to treat their civilian populations and minorities with a level of violence, with a level of brutality that doesn't result simply in their expulsion or their migration, but in their physical destruction.
All right. Before we are now at the halfway point, and I'd like to identify you again. You are listening to Professor Ruben Adalyan, the director of the Armenian National Institute, located in Washington. I am your host, Ned Apigyan, of the program called Then and Now, which its point of view is how history affects current events. And if you don't understand the history of events, the current events don't mean much to you. And we are the college radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, located in Dearborn, Michigan, broadcasting on 89.3 FM, and by the way, this is a pre-recorded program. You can't call the station. You can listen to us on the internet by going into the internet and searching out WHFR.FM, and you could listen to us live that way. It'll say live, or you can go into our podcasted programs, hit the button that says forum, and you can listen to any program. The programs are identified by date. The forum programs are one a week from 10 to 11 in the morning. And if you pick the fourth Saturday of every month, you will listen, you will hear the programs that I have done. So now back to our study of genocide. One of the points I wanted to make, and you might be able to elaborate on before we leave the actual Armenian genocide as to what actually happened and the results we're not talking about in great detail, is that the expansion of Tsarist Russia and the 1876 war in Russia and its effect in its eventual peace treaty in Berlin and how the great powers changed it, and the eventual establishment of a commission to make sure that the Armenians in the empire were treated fairly and right, did not help the future situation of the Armenians as far as the Turks were concerned. What would you have to say about that as an issue of concern, since the allies of the great powers did not let Russia keep what it conquered from the Turks?
Well, this is one of the central and questions about that particular instance, and curiously, it remains a question to this very day, which is, what's the level of intervention that the international community should engage in when there is a situation that seemingly is threatening the very lives of significant numbers of people? And does pressuring a government really result in the modification of their behavior and the improvement of the conditions in which targeted or endangered minorities find themselves.
So when the Turks decided to join the Germans and the Central Powers, so the problem of the under the cover of the World War I, it gave them the opportunity to eliminate this scourge that was put upon them with this commission prior to the beginning of the war to safeguard their minorities, and they acted upon it.
Well, and this is one of the responses that you get, or one of the type of responses that you get from states that are reluctant to modify their behavior and modify their policies, which is to find allies that would agree with them or provide them cover, and when opportunity does arise, and this is why war is regarded as frequently the opportunity during which genocide is committed, then becomes a valuable option for extremist regimes.
And of course, Hilmar Kaiser says that the German state had a very important involvement in the attempt of genocide of the Armenians too. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Well, yes, but it's a known fact that in forging an alliance with Germany, we're talking about Turkey during World War One
with
the Ottoman Empire. That positioned Turkey in a way to avoid submitting to the pressure from the other states and to forging its own independent policy and in having a free hand in the way it governed and in the way it treated its population, and particularly minorities. Okay. Moreover, the level of German participation on the Turkish fronts during World War One was such that the Germans were entirely aware and fully informed of the mistreatment of the Armenians. They knew about the deportations, they knew about the massacres, and effectively did not lift a finger to stop them, which is where the argument comes to whether they were complicit, certainly they tolerated, and whether they were also complicit in the Armenian genocide.
So now we're post the World War One, it's the 1920s, the Peace Treaty of Versailles, the Peace Treaty of Sèvres, the Peace Treaty of Lausanne, issues that I've covered in the past. The issue of genocide is not brought up then. It's not really brought up till the post-World War II, and now we have the very well-known Jewish Holocaust, which I don't think much has to be said about it. Hopefully you can, I think the most important thing that our audience needs to know about that, but which they don't already, may not already know, is Hitler's supposed comment prior to the invasion of Poland in August of 1939, that so who today remembers the annihilation of the genocide, and therefore no one is going to be concerned about what we do now. I think that's the most important issue that the average person doesn't know. They know very much about the Jewish genocide. Not that we don't want to go into it, but would you care to say something about that as an important issue?
It's a very important issue, and for the
Jewish Holocaust, we're talking
as to what happened after the First World War is essential to understanding why the problem of genocide has persisted. And you pointed out that all these treaties, peace treaties, were signed to resolve or to bring about peace in Europe and elsewhere.
And they didn't talk about genocide, did they?
The one thing that they chose to overlook in the process of signing, ultimately, although some treaties, the Treaty of Sèvres did allude to it and did try to address it, but ultimately, the entire matter of the extermination of the Armenian population was completely buried through the course of these treaties and entirely overlooked, and the Armenian population effectively left to its own resources. And we're talking by this point of, you know, the people that were that numbered perhaps 2 million or so in 1915 are down to 500,000 and less in what remained of the Ottoman Empire, 1.5 million Armenians having perished in the course of those years. And so you have the question of this enormous crime, which is where Lemkin's question comes as well, where he asks.
Yeah, we need to identify him after the war as to how.
Right,
but
this is where his thinking parallels Hitler's thinking, but in a totally contrastive way. Hitler draws the lesson that if so many Armenians could be exterminated, and the world goes on, and there's absolutely no penalty to destroying an entire population, then what's to stop him from killing and murdering any number of Jews or other peoples that he intended to
eliminate,
to conquer, or designate as
subhuman,
according to racial theories, as people,
right,
people who would be eliminated. Whereas, in contrast, Raphael Lemkin, himself a Jew from Poland. And a trained attorney, is drawing the opposite lesson. And asking the question, if a murder is committed, if a single individual is killed, you have a whole legal system that responds by arresting the accused and holding a trial, whereas when 1.5 million individuals are killed, there's neither a designation for the crime nor a legal mechanism for bringing anybody to justice.
Wasn't it Stalin that said the loss of one individual is a tragedy, but the loss of millions is only a statistic?
Something
like that.
And this is precisely why I started talking about the escalation of violence during the First World War, which is as more and more numbers, and this is one of the things that human populations around the world became adjusted to, regrettably, is the astonishing numbers of lives lost during the First World War, both in warfare and in genocide. And, of course, those numbers multiplied during the Second World War.
Okay,
but by that instance, that's to say the Second War, those numbers were so astronomical in the tens of millions of people that the world reacted very, very differently.
What I'd like to get to in terms of the Second World War and the Jewish Holocaust, which we're all very much familiar with, I'd like to break it into two parts. The first thing is, we mentioned that Hitler's pronouncement that the forgotten Armenian genocide, and no one remembers it, gives him license to do what he did. But the actual genocide of the Jews comes in two phases. First, there's the nonviolent phase, the removal of Jews from Germany, of which the average person doesn't realize. They don't care where the Jews went as long as they left Germany. Once they occupied most of Europe, that same philosophy was holding true. They were sending them to different places. The idea that they would eliminate all the Jews, physically murder them, was a second phase that probably didn't begin until 1942. By that time, the war is 2.5 years old before they actually make a decision as to what to do with this problem. You might want to talk about that.
Well, I wouldn't characterize the first phase as nonviolent, and I don't think that's how you meant it.
No, I meant
what you meant to say, non-exterminatory.
The final solution, actually.
Or non-genocidal.
Non-genocidal.
That, the racial laws that were introduced with the installment of the Nazi regime, and henceforth you know, actually did inject a good deal of violence, but the extermination policies, you're quite correct, were not introduced until the war. So
there
are two phases. But you pointing that out is also important, because there's always a preparatory phase to genocide. It's nearly infeasible to, in a sense, turn on a switch and implement something so inhuman as the extermination of 1.5 million Armenians or 6 million Jews or any number of other human beings, because any society would presumably and arguably react to that level of violence. And what regimes do, genocidal regimes do, is prepare their societies to tolerate genocidal behavior by increasing, calibrating in the violence and increasing it over the course of months and years until such time when the full explosion occurs, the rest of society actually stays out of the way.
Yeah, there's an interesting theory. What was that? Was they would send all the Jews to Madagascar before the war started?
Right. Early on, within typically with the regimes that want to rid themselves of a population, the first option that they entertain is simply deporting them, expelling them, sending them somewhere out of the way.
And the Turks didn't give the Armenians that option. Their option was to convert or die, as I remember. So the Germans went into... Most people don't know about that Madagascar story. I hope it's true, because I've said it. Do you have anything to add to it?
You're correct, and... But you know, in the general proposition that the early expectation was that if they applied sufficient pressure, that most Jews would emigrate, and many did, of course. And in hindsight, those who did emigrate saved their lives, and if they happened to have taken their families out, of course, saved their families. They're nearly all lost their properties and their living and their fortunes.
Okay, we're at the three-quarter point. We have a quarter left, of which we're going to talk about the post-World War definition. We'll talk about where Lafayette Lampkin's invention. Let me identify. We're listening to Professor Ruben Adalyan, director of the Armenian National Institute in Washington. I am Ned Apigian, your host. You are listening to us on WHFR. 89.3 FM on your radio dial. We are the college radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, broadcasting from Dearborn, Michigan. And this is the name of our program is Then and Now, How History Affects Current Events. We're discussing genocide into three or four or five divisions so we can make some sense of it. That's a big subject to cover and less than 55 minutes. And now, we're all pretty well familiar with the Jewish genocide. I think the major difference between it is most of the people who were Jews in Germany were considered themselves Germans. They were not a foreign minority like the Armenians, who resided at least 2,000 years on their own homeland and were subjected, removed, and or massacred. These were people that considered themselves Germans and were part of the culture they were from. The Dutch people, Jews, considered themselves Dutch. Now we get into the definition. The post-World War II, Raphael Lemkin, why did he come up with this definition? What did the UN do about this? Let's talk about that.
Well, after the Second World War, as the scale of the Nazi atrocities became evident, and as Lemkin himself had come to realize, the very nature of the crime, the simply incomprehensible evil committed, required the coining of the term in order to label it and in order to raise this issue in the consciences of humankind. And that's the origin.
Is it true that Lemkin invented the term in relationship to the Armenian genocide before the Second World War?
The term itself dates from 1943-44, when the Holocaust was already in progress, and this is why. I talked about his awareness of the Armenians, and their mistreatment, and the questions that he was asking as a young lawyer. Although it takes him better part of 10-15 years and the repetition of history to coin the term, he's aware that there is a problem. And of course, it isn't just the coining of a term, but his life's effort to persuade the United Nations, then a newly formed organization, to adopt a convention in 1948, in order to criminalize and hopefully prevent.
Which, so far to date, I don't think anybody has been found guilty of that, maybe except for Milosevic.
Well, Milosevic's trial never ended because he died. Passed away. But there have been individuals who have been out of the situation in Bosnia and in Rwanda who have been charged with a commission of genocide.
So did Lemkin actually make a lot of references to the Armenian genocide in order to define what the meaning of the Holocaust?
Lemkin undertook a study of history to observe this problem to see if he could identify the features, the elements that made up the question of genocide in formulating his word. And of course, the Armenian example was fresh in his memory because it occurred in his lifetime and he'd been aware of it as he read about it. And in the case of the Holocaust, of course, he experienced it himself. His own family perished.
So would you say
he is a man who perhaps the first man of the 20th century who fully comprehends, who is fully sensitized to the enormity of the problem of genocide.
So would you say the Armenian genocide had as much to do with the definition of the term genocide as the Jewish Holocaust by Lemkin's?
It probably did in his thinking because of the choices.
I thought he was more specific about it.
Genocide meaning the extermination of a group or of a specific race, and it would apply both in the case of the Jews. It would apply in the case of the Armenians. It would apply in the case of other populations as well.
Which we'll talk about after. Now we have 1948. We have this term defined. And defined as a punishable crime, right?
Right.
With specific issues, why we find today this issue with the Turkish government and its relationship with the United States really hates that term because why?
Well, if a country is a signatory to the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, there's an obligation to act in the instance of the commission of a genocide. And therefore, therein lies the explanation why governments are so reticent to apply that label when there are crimes being committed against civilian populations, because it would obligate them to do something about it.
So we have reparations, we have return of land, issues of property, which complicate the issue.
Those would be presumably post-war or post-genocidal issues. The central concern with anybody who studies the problem of genocide is its prevention, or if it's occurring, intervention. And this is where the U.S. government or any
other
government simply don't want to be put in a position of being obligated by law to have to intervene. And since the United States is effectively about the only country in the world that has the resources to do something about a genocidal situation halfway around the world, then the burden is considerable on our authorities to decide what to do and what to label or what not to label. And hence the continuing hesitation and the foot dragging that we frequently find. And having said that, ultimately and finally, in, in the most current case of mass atrocities against the civilian population, that of Darfur,
right,
which did receive the designation of genocide by the Department of State, even then did not necessarily result in elevated engagement of the type that might have put a stop to it.
So we have
increased public attention. It perhaps increased the level of diplomatic intervention. Perhaps increase the amount of aid provided, but the logistical challenge of how to intervene to stop a murderous regime from killing a large number of civilians, unarmed civilians typically, remains a
So that brings us to our last couple of minutes to say something about Cambodia, Rwanda, and eventually Darfur, which we got ahead of ourselves a little bit. I'm wondering why the United States, that has these airborne divisions, why they didn't fly and drop these people in Darfur and solve that problem. They spent a whole lot of money and expense in having these things. I don't know what you do with them if you can't use them to eliminate genocide. And I don't know what good they are. So tell us something about, we have about 3 minutes left, about Cambodia. It happened. Actually, the regime was overthrown, so that solved that problem. And Rwanda, anything happen? Anybody try to correct anything?
I think, given the limitations of time, let me simply say this: the case of Rwanda and Cambodia are reminders, and the fresher one of Darfur, among others, that genocide is not something that happens in just one part of the world, or it's not a problem or a crime faced by any one people alone or two people here or there. The genocide has occurred around the world.
To white people, black people, brown people. There's no...
peoples in all continents. It's one of the major challenges that humanity faces as it continues to construct the modern state and modern societies. And ultimately it comes down to what type of government is formed, what type of laws are instituted, and that the concern for justice and equality remains central to the concerns of any government, I think is essential to resolving and ending the problem of genocide. Without the focus on humanity, without the focus on justice, without the focus on equality, the problem will remain.
You know what? That brings me to an interesting thing. We always hear about the Holocaust and the loss of 6 million Jews. I think our listeners should be aware that the Nazis did a job of killing more than 14 million people in their death factories. Jews may have been 6 million. There is approximately 8 million other people that they regarded as subhuman, from Slavic peoples to gypsies and those of many strange orientations. That the Nazi Holocaust, dear listeners, consumed 14 million people in their death camps, not just 6 million Jews, not to mention almost 50 million people that were consumed by the Second World War, which they initiated by attacking Poland on September 1st, 1939. So we have a minute to wrap up. Why don't you take a moment to see how you could summarize all this? I think you're almost started. You got about a half a minute, 30 seconds to do that. And go ahead.
Well, I think what needs to be said is, if there is a genocidal situation, there needs to be intervention. If there is to be intervention, the international community needs to create some mechanism, some process where it can respond quickly enough to save lives. If the intervention comes too late, then and these massive numbers of deaths continue to occur because of one outlaw regime or another, then I think we have failed in fulfilling the promise of humanity.
Professor Adalyan, thank you very much. This has been an informative interview, and we hope you enjoyed being our guest as well as we enjoyed you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
have been listening to Then and Now, a pre-recorded program brought to you from 10 to 11 a.m. on the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of our talk show format entitled the WHFR Forum. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events by your host, Ned Apigian, on WHFR 89.3 FM, making waves from the campus of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. You can also hear this program on the World Wide Web at www.whfr.fm. Thank you.